Exactly. I'm gonna be there. Hello. Great. So we're gonna have a great session today. My name is Jenny Chen. I am the founder and CEO of Three Hills. I started this company 6, 7 years ago, with the intention of three goals. One is to educate everyone about 3D printing, additive manufacturing, and how it can be applied in healthcare, and that includes bioprinting and also adjacent 3D technologies. So that's number one mission, is to educate everyone about these deep tech. Number two is to create a network environment. In the past, we host in-person events, but because of the pandemic, a lot of things changed. We shifted to almost 100% virtual, like this one, but we're actually slowly easing into hybrid event. And I think the pandemic is a bit of provided a silver lining, because we now can do event in such a way to reach a wider audience with more network capability. So stay tuned for those hybrid events in your area. And number three is we also have a program called Pitch 3D, where we help early stage startups, which means you're before Series B, with fundraising. And we are connected to more than 30 institutional investors, corporate investors, VC angel groups. So for those of you who are interested, apply to the program or reach out to me. We can have a chat. I don't mind if you're having a premature conversation. I enjoy talking about that. We want to move on to today's theme, which is melt electrowriting and its relationship to 3D printing and how it can be applied in healthcare and biotech. And it started to become more and more interesting. One is you can see an increased publication in this area. And I would say a leading author is here on the screen with us today, Professor Paul Dalton. And two is I'm starting to seeing startups in the area as well, and you will see some speakers today presenting their material. So without further ado, I think the best first speaker of today's event will be Professor Dalton, who published numerous papers on the subject, and I also shared some of the YouTube videos. And I will let him take over and teach us about melt electrowriting.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. So Jenny, you can see the slides?
Yes.
Looks great, excellent. Look, thanks everyone for joining. It's really nice to have a session dedicated to an emerging technology, and I want to go through some of the basics of the work as well as some of the applications and also ways to access the technology a bit easier. So I've been in the US since about April 2021, and my lab is a manufacturing-specific laboratory where we do the basic research of manufacturing, but we have the guardrails of the regulatory process. So what that means is we look at using polymers that are medical-grade polymers. So we don't use industrial polymers. We use known biodegradable polymers, often used in suture materials. We don't use any solvents, and that solves so many things in your life. There's no need for ventilation. It's a much more stable to process things without solvents. And it does allow for things like automatic in-process control, accessing open source technologies as well as scale. So I wanted to start off by, talking about the philosophy that I approached this field about just over 20 years ago. And that's that biomaterials have been safely manufactured for decades using melt processing. It's a known way that you can manufacture things such as sutures, hernia meshes, bone screws, urethral stents, and spinal cages. And so when I started working in a new area at the time in early 2000 of electrospinning, I really thought that working with melt electrospinning was a no-brainer because of all of the things known about how to translate biomaterials. And so while the amount of electrospinning research has been heavily dominated with solution electrospinning, having that solvent there really kind of created issues and also other issues about definitions about whether it's a scaffold or a membrane. And I'll get onto that a little bit later. So the reason I wanted to talk about that is some of the first electrowriting or electrospinning samples that I got were really underwhelming. And so, even though this was sort of one of the nicer samples at the time, I was able to keep working at getting the processing conditions right. So we're actually electrospinning, and then this turned into electro-writing. We're able to accurately place every single fiber. And so this evolution, which is taking a long time, was really driven by the belief that using melt-processed polymers is really a way to clinically translate materials, because that's the way it's been done for decades. So just to kind of get the definitions right, here's a video of solution electrospinning, where what you'll do is you have a polymer solution here, and you'll basically overcharge this fluid so that it creates this kind of whipping event here. And so when you're making very small fibers, and these are typically sub-micron diameter fibers, this is because of the overcharging of this solution. You have this whipping. Melt electrowriting, however, uses a lesser voltage and a more viscous material to actually stabilize this jet. And so we make small diameter fibers, not by overcharging, but by lowering the flow rate. So typically what we'll be doing in the lab is we'll be pushing the melt to the nozzle at about 5 microliters per hour, even into the nanoliters per hour rate if we want to have very small fibers. And so you can see now that here's the nozzle and here's the melt coming out of it. And this can thin out dramatically. And it's not thinning out because we're stretching it, because we're moving the collector fast. It's because we're applying a voltage and we're lowering the flow rate to the nozzle. And this is a not a very well-known phenomenon. I don't have much time to go into today, but you can actually see here's a video of a floating water bridge where water, and this is like pure deionized water, is actually suspended by applying voltages here. And this is really the sort of underlying physical effect for melt electrowriting. But other than that, is very similar to regular 3D printing, where you have a nozzle where a hot thermoplastic comes out, it thins out, it cools and solidifies. And so it's used commonly in biomedical engineering to make porous materials called scaffolds. And so we can sort of layer up this thin jet over and over again to make highly porous structures. And here's a picture of some of the thicker scaffolds. So this is really a technology which makes scaffolds that are about up to about half a millimeter in size, but it can be up to 7 millimeters thick, as you see in the sample here. And typically these scaffolds are really porous. And so they have a porosity typically above 85%. There's a lot of space for cells to organize amongst each other. And so here's an example of a 98% porous scaffold, where it's quite typical for cells that are ECM depositing and proliferating to fill up these pores and actually form these confluent cell sheets. The fibers made with melt electrowriting are far smaller than regular 3D printing and can also be altered as you perform the print. So here's an example of this is a single print with the same diameter nozzle, and we're able to, through calibration, be able to hit 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 microns, with that 30 micron diameter, the largest that you see here, still much, much smaller than the smallest you can make with regular 3D printing. This allows also for things like making objects or scaffolds that have different sizes to them. So this was a scaffold made by a dental student in Germany, where I was previously. And so on this side here, this is meant to anchor into the muscle. And this has 10 micron diameter fibers spaced 125 apart. If we flip it over, and there's a membrane that's in the middle here, if we flip it over, this is meant to anchor into the bone component. And so these are 25 micron diameter fibers, 250 microns apart, all of which made single print, same nozzle. And so this is like a feature that melt electrowriting has in its ability to change diameter as you print. The fibers have been used for reinforcing weak matrices and bio inks. So here's an example of the scaffold itself is quite weak and hydrogels are quite weak. But when you put them together, there's a synergistic reinforcement effect up to 50-fold strong for compressive forces. And this video here shows like a very, very weak Matrigel solution, which you just can't pick up at all. By putting a small amount of MEW fibers in there, it allows you to facilitate the movement and handling. So what this does is open up a larger design space for some of the matrices and bioinks that we use, where we don't have to continually stiffen the bioink so that it can hold its shape, and actually gives more room for the cells to function and perform in the way that we would like them to. This reinforcement effect is also demonstrated here, where this orange curve is the stress strain of the hydrogel itself. And then when it's embedded within this particular scaffold, you have a very, very tough material. One of the complexities of melt electrowriting is you have a lot of different parameters that you are using at the same time. And so the key parameters in getting melt electrowriting to work really well is the melt temperature, to have sufficient heat to the polymer to melt it, to apply the pressure or to be able to push the melt to the nozzle. The voltage that you apply is also important, as well as the collector speed. And there are other variables as well, but in general, they have minor roles, and the process is generally forgiving as well. So everything doesn't have to be perfectly balanced. And primarily what the field has been using is polycaprolactone. It's a degradable polymer. It's a 2-year degrade. It takes 2 years to degrade. And what's interesting is the gold standard polymer used for melt electrowriting is the medical grade polymer. So there's a lot of data and information out there for the GMP manufactured polymers that you would actually be needing to translate through to the clinic. And there's a whole range of different shapes and architectures that you can use. But I also wanted to highlight some other polymers as well. This is some nice work on liquid crystal elastomers that were actually made with an auxetic design. And through the cooling and actually heating, you can create this reversible change in shape. And so it's not just the biomedical area that has interest in this, but also other fields as well. And so for melt electrowriting, there's all of these different tissues across the body, which have, you know, just started to be investigated. One of the advantages of very small fibers is you have a lot of design space where you can kind of build up structures. And I just wanted to highlight a recent paper, because there was a 3D heels for bioprinting of skin recently. Also, there's a recent paper that came out in a collaboration that I had with L'Oreal for the past 5 years, where we're looking at creating skin structures that actually mimic human. And what we used here is a combination of solution electrospinning, which is here, as well as melt electrowriting. And this looks a little bit dense because the field of view for the SEM is quite high, but this is about 85% porosity. And so by having a scaffold and a membrane and then being able to seed cells, we're able to recreate skin tissue quite nicely. And so this is the result of a 5-year project. We have a lot of the ECM that is formed that you'd expect. But I just want to sort of highlight as well, we have nicely polarized keratinocytes, as well as a lot of the keratin as well that's being laid down in the filaggrin. So you can see that what we're making is actually a really nice structure. And it only takes 18 days in vitro to form this artificial skin. And so working with industry has been one of the things that's been really interesting. Working in academia, and there's this gap between what we're doing at universities and what the private sector is doing. And I also wanted to highlight as well, a lot of the systems and the for example, bioprinters and melt electrowriting printers are made by the private sector and are pushed on to universities so that we can do the research. But they're often like over-engineered and very expensive. So we've taken this approach of looking at hobby 3D printers and actually converting them into very powerful research tools. The benefits are that such printers will cost like $1,000, and there's a lot of modifications that you can do here. And so you can see we have like several melt electrowriting systems here, all self-built. And by the fact that we can purchase these and convert them quite inexpensively, our lab has, I think, around about 15 or 17 melt electrowriting printers, and they're all custom designed to do one specific task or do one certain thing, rather than have a all-in-one system that tries to make every structure possible. One of the, it's not a new concept to use open source printers for biomedical research. But you know, really, there's an exceptional value for money that you get from this. There's no single company that sells these printers, so they never will go out of business. They're incredibly modifiable, and the cost is so low. You don't have to worry about having the warranty voided by opening them up and changing that you would have on a more expensive system. But still, that expensive system is needed later on in the pipeline. So this just fills in a certain point. You do need to have the ability to assemble 3D printers and have familiarity there. And of course, the precision isn't as high as the expensive systems, but it gets you about 90% there. And so we see that at the university level, there's an opportunity for that. We've adopted the Voron 3D printer. This is really evolved from the original RepRap project in 3D printing. And this conversion of the Voron to the Muron is relatively simple, and there's a lot of nice aspects about it. So if I just show this short video of where we get the Voron open source printer and this very small footprint structure, and what we can do is we actually replace some of the parts in there as we accommodate for the high voltage that's being used on both the collector plate as well as the head, which we have a whole bunch of parts which we push away, and we swap this over into something that is more amenable to doing melt electro writing. And there's a lot of little features and details that you can go in and modify as well. So these are quite fascinating systems. They're compact, and they allow you to have filament-driven systems, which we're doing a lot more of, and these are great to work with, as well as syringe-based systems. The results as well aren't too bad as well. So here's an example of 1.5 micron. We have 300 layers stacked upon each other. And so the resolution of what you can achieve is really nice. It also allows you to be able to modify things for specific materials. So like in this instance, we wanted to process a high temperature polymer. And so we wanted to make a tube as well. So we ended up modifying this Voron into a system where we also have a tilted fan. We just kind of move it up a little bit so it doesn't cool down the melt so much. This small difference makes a big change. We have a heated mandrel by the radiation that comes off some copper plates here. And this whole system was really allowed us to very quickly sort of produce work and get something like nylon 12 microfibers working, also polyethylene working as a material. And so, you know, we've really embraced using these. I'm just going to be finishing off now as well, but really just wanted to mention that having hobby printers, which you modify, so we've converted the Voron, and it's now into the Muron that we call it, it really empowers people to innovate. And so this is Andrew and Paolo, who are in our team. And, you know, when they finished up their postdocs in my lab, they just took these printers back with them just because they're so low cost and accessible. So I just wanted to summarize this opening talk by sort of highlighting that advanced manufacturing research can be enhanced by considering the regulatory process. There are large animal trials happening at the moment in Australia and Netherlands. I think in Australia, they're looking towards human implantation. And also these new tools that we have are only as good as you use them. And so really trying to use them in a certain and intelligent way, and also combining technologies such as bioprinting, melt electrowriting, electrospinning, and you know, to highlight this powerful open source approach isn't just related to melt electrowriting, but many other technologies. And yeah, we're still to get to the peak of the hype cycle for melt electrowriting. It's still not very well known. And the final recommendation really is as soon as you get rid of solvents in your research, your life gets better. And so not having solvents there means you don't have to worry about toxicity and solvent accumulation. And there's a lot of freedom that comes with that. So with that, I will stop my talk and also thank some wonderful people that I've been able to work with over the years. Want to highlight a good colleague, Dietmar Huttmacher, as well as, you know, people like Ander and Paula, Naomi, Evgeny and Simon, who really helped set up and establish the lab. So with that, I'm happy to stop and hand it over to the next person. Thank you.
Awesome, Paul. We have a couple questions from the audience. Actually, one is pretty relevant to the last part of your presentation. And I don't even know if you have a real answer, because this Formlab 3, as my understanding, is a SLA type of printer. So I don't know if you can convert that into a MEW printing machine.
Yeah, I mean, we like the Voron because it really is that true open source descendant of the RepRap system. And it's a core XY, meaning that the build plate just goes up and down in the Z axis and then the XY. And that's good if you want to like put liquids or anything onto the build plate that it's not, not moving around. So we just like the configuration, all the documentation that's there, and the community for the Voron is in the tens of thousands worldwide. So it's really well represented.
I should definitely take a look at that. I mean, before this presentation, I did not know their existence. In fact, I actually did a very extensive search for commercial printer makers. I think Regenhub is making something like that. And there's some company, I forgot the name, in Turkey. But and maybe in Philippos, we will see his presentation soon. But the commercial side is, like you said, is mostly open source. And I kind of like it, actually. I feel like we need it.
Yeah, even in the bioprinting community, the first selling printers, the Incredibles, had many of these open source systems in it. And right. They were $5,000 at the time, comprising $900 worth of parts. And so that was a great way for people to get involved in it. And now, of course, the price has gone up. Now it's $50,000 or so. But, you know, that open source system is a great way to start. And it has a place in the research ecosystem.
Yeah, I actually almost feel like maybe in the bioprinting space, we're kind of prematurely commercializing some of the stuff. But anyways, we have another question from Berthing Clement. In the dental printing that you showed, I think one of your papers, that there is a membrane separating the muscle and bone scaffold. How did you create that kind of layer? Was this one scaffold printed on the membrane and then flipped?
Yeah, no, it was printed all in a single go. So what we did was we printed the larger fibers, and then we created that fine membrane. And that's just by changing the flow rate and the pressures to the nozzle. And so, that's made in a single print.
One go.
And nice. So that helps a lot, especially if you want to scale, because then you can parallelize the nozzles, and then you can make all of those at the same time without trying to stop and start and move around.
Right, and more chance to error. Which slicer software technology can we use for MEW?
We write in G-code. We use MATLAB. We use MATLAB scripts to generate this, and I think Naomi may touch on this as well. So there isn't really that kind of drop and drag and automatic slicing, because the technology is just so early. And there's a few special things that you have to consider. That makes it a bit different, but I'm sure we'll be there one day.
By the way, speaking of G-code, it's definitely something I want to learn, at least kind of inspired to learn, because last year one of our viral Instagram reels is actually a professor from an architecture professor who's teaching G-code. His post generated almost a million views, because once you have the G-code, you know how to do G-code, you can control the machine like magic. Is what I'm understanding. So awesome. So everyone, if you have more questions, just put in the QA box. We'll address it later. Thank you so much, Professor. We're going to move on to the next speaker, and we'll have some time at the end, and we'll do a panel discussion. So next speaker up is Dr. Naomi Paxton. She is actually in Australia very early in the morning. Thank you so much, Naomi, for joining us this early. She is a senior research fellow in the field of biofabrication and 3D printing and leader of the BioInspired Additive Manufacturing Group in Brisbane, Australia. Sorry.
Hi, thank you so much, Jenny. I'm really happy to be here presenting. Of course, I'm, as Jenny said, joining you from Mianjin, Brisbane, Australia. And so I'd like to start by, acknowledging the First Nations traditional owners of the lands in which I work and presenting from today and conduct my research. And these are, of course, the lands of the Turrbal and the Yuggera people as the First Nations owners of the lands where QUT now stands. So I'd like to pose an overarching research question that really sort of underpins a lot of my research, which is how can we design biomimetic scaffolds that can replicate both the biological and the mechanical properties of natural materials? And so this is really the starting point for a lot of the work that that I've been doing and my research team using melt electrowriting. And sort of taking these fundamental biomimetic design principles within the biofabrication context, which is biocompatibility, biomimetic mechanical properties, and of course, personalization. And 3D printing is such a wonderful technique that enables us to kind of realize all of these three design principles with the level of precision and control that we have over designs, and of course, the flexibility to reproducing one-off parts, which lends itself so naturally to creating patient-specific products. So as Paul has wonderfully introduced for us, we use melt electrowriting in our research, which is this absolutely brilliant micron scale 3D printing technique. And so just in this wonderful animation produced by my colleague, Dr. Sean Powell, we can see here the difference between the typical scaffold that would be produced with FDM printing, a fused filament fabrication printing, compared to the scale of a melt electrowritten scaffold. And so this is using fibers that are up to an order of magnitude smaller than fused filament fabrication printed scaffolds. And this lends itself really well to improving cell attachment and improving the biomimetic 3D environment that cells would experience when seeded onto that, compared to the far more sort of nearly 2D surface that the cells would interact with on these much larger fiber sizes. So a lot of the research that we've been undertaking that has sort of come up in conversation just now is around increasing the design freedom and the level of control we have over scaffold design. And so this is one of our early studies where we were looking at increasing the level of complexity over the scaffolds that we could produce. So we all love our typical crosshatch scaffolds, which are shown in panel A there, but then increasing the level of complexity to having a gradient of pore sizes across the scaffold, as Paul introduced, printing on a rotating mandrel to produce tubular scaffolds, and then designing a workflow that allows us to translate patient scan data into a digital 3D model of the required patient-specific implant, and then turn that into the G-code, which is specific for melt electrowriting, so that we're able to print these scaffolds using this continuous filament production, where we can't necessarily easily start and stop the flow of the fiber. So we need to be able to manufacture these all within a single continuous line. And you can see in E there how all of these sort of connecting fibers are needed to jump between the different regions of this ear cartilage scaffold. And of course, all of these have been printed with our material of choice, which is polycaprolactone, which Paul introduced to us. Excuse me. And PCL is a wonderful material to print with using melt electrowriting. It melts at about 60 degrees, which means we can print it at sub 100 degrees, which is excellent. And it cools rapidly. So we're able to create these beautiful scaffolds where the fibers can fuse to produce these really mechanically robust scaffolds. So kind of extending on the degrees of design freedom, these are some new patterns that my team have been developing to print onto a rotating tubular mandrel to make tubular scaffolds. And so the exciting kind of avenues with this, with some of these patterns is to be able to really tightly control the mechanical properties of your tubular scaffolds. So the diamond scaffolds have quite a lot of longitudinal elasticity. If we start to incorporate things like auxetic patterns using this bow tie structure, these bow ties actually expand as you longitudinally stretch the tube. And so this means radially the tube will expand rather than collapse in what's called negative Poisson's ratio mechanical behavior. And so some of these other designs, as you can see, allow us to independently control the longitudinal or the radial elasticity of these scaffolds by, for example, offsetting the joins between the unit cells to give us varying degrees of stiffness. And so then what these students showed, which was excellent, is then incorporating multiple of these patterns within one scaffold. And so here there are three regions of different auxetic designs, which, as I mentioned, as you stretch the scaffold, it means the scaffold will expand. But here we can see we can now selectively control to what degree the scaffold expands across the length of the scaffold, which is opening up some really exciting avenues for mechanical control over the properties of the scaffolds that we're producing. So here we've compared simply changing the angle at which these fibers intersect and start to look at the role that this has in controlling the ability for cells that are seated on these scaffolds to bridge across the pores and fill and align across the scaffolds, as well as the subsequent mechanical behavior. And so you can see here that these have all been printed with the same fiber diameter, with the same porosity, but by simply changing the angle at which those fibers intersect, we can elicit a really wide range of mechanical properties. And this gives us a huge degree of design freedom in being able to replicate specific mechanical properties of native tissues and then design specific architectures of our scaffolds that would be able to match that. So we've gone another step further from experimental characterization. And here with some wonderful collaborators, we've developed a simulation of how different tubular scaffolds behave in different mechanical loading regimes. And so now we can map all of the properties of different combinations of pore sizes and angles to see what mechanical properties this will yield. And this is particularly exciting in some of the loading regimes that it's actually extremely difficult for us to measure experimentally. So for example, radial tensile stretching would typically be measured with, for example, a balloon expansion system. And these are really tricky to work with and require very expensive machinery. But now we have access to a validated model that allows us to predict all of the mechanical behavior across these different mechanical loading regimes. So we can use this to then inform our scaffold design so that we can match specific tissue mechanical properties. And so here is a study where we have wanted to kind of increase the design complexity of tubular melt electrowritten scaffolds. And so, of course, as you saw from Paul's talk and from earlier, we print onto a metal rotating mandrel. But to be able to design patient-specific structures, for example, we may want to augment the geometry of that. And so the best way that we have found to do that, and other studies have shown to do this, is to use a non-conductive mold onto that cylinder and then melt electrolyte onto that mold. But of course, demolding the scaffolds can be quite a challenge, particularly with melt electrowritten scaffolds that can be quite fragile. And so here we're exploring where there is negative curvature, how we can use a degradable 3D printed mold using a water-soluble filament. And so you can see how very quickly, in just a couple of minutes, we can dissolve the mold, and we're left with the melt electrowritten scaffold without having to sort of twist and bend it across our molds. And then we validated this with a patient-specific case study by also combining kind of an electrospinning and melt electrowriting scaffolds in combination here. We've also been really interested in augmenting the mechanical properties of our scaffolds as well as the biological properties by changing the materials that we're using. And so PCL is a wonderful material because it's so easy to print. But here we have incorporated bioactive glass. So this is a strontium substituted bioactive glass that we have been using in collaboration with Professor Molly Stevens' lab at Imperial College London. And so we're including up to 33 weight percent, so really high concentrations of bioactive glass into our PCL scaffolds. So we can rely on the easy printability and the low melting point of the PCL phase, but then we have the bioactive glass component, which is a ceramic phase, which really closely mimics the native ceramic phase of bone. And so we've found in quite extensive in vitro and in vivo studies that I don't have the data for today, but we've shown how wonderfully bone cells will interact with these scaffolds compared to PCL alone to add a level of bioactivity and induce far more rapid bone regeneration in these scaffolds. So I'd like to show some beautiful images that my PhD student Brenna has developed showing how cells interact on different scaffold designs. And so we're really here, we're trying to pair the beautiful ability that we have to control the porosity and the pore designs of our different scaffolds with how cells then interact on these. And so Brenna has found some really amazing results of how we can tune establishing a consistent porosity, but then changing the interaction distances between these fibers that allow cells to, for example, spontaneously bridge across these pores and start to fill and develop into more mature tissues far more rapidly. So I'd like to just sort of take us through this biomimetic design workflow that I introduced in the context of a really important clinical challenge that I've been focusing on. And so this is the treatment of microtia, which is a congenital condition characterized by the malformation of the external ear. And so in some cases, patients may choose a surgical approach to restore the geometry in the external kind of anatomy of the ear. And so here we're taking through these three design principles of incorporating biocompatibility. And in this case, we'd like to use polyethylene as the printed material, which is the material that is used in the existing FDA cleared products. We would like to incorporate biomimetic mechanical properties. And this is really in response to some of the reports of breakage of the surgical implants in approximately 5% of cases. And so our goal here is to incorporate more biomimetic mechanical properties of the scaffold to reduce the incident rate of those complications. And then finally, of course, leverage 3D printing's wonderful ability to be able to print one-off patient-specific products as well, which is so important for anatomies such as the ear, where we all have very unique anatomies. So I undertook this project at Paul Dalton's lab at the University of Oregon. And so I was really fortunate to spend 12 months as a postdoc there working in his team. And so I was able to use the wonderful technology that his team's been developing using the Muron, so the converted Voron melt electrowriting machines here. And this gives us a lot of freedom in being able to process a wider range of material, including much higher melting temperature polymers like polyethylene compared to polycaprolactone. And so using this system, we were able to melt electrolyte for the first time high density polyethylene. And so this involved heating the material to significantly higher temperatures, up to 250 degrees, compared to the about 100 degrees that we typically print PCL at. And we got some really wonderful results with this system, which I'll show briefly. So firstly, we were able to produce these wonderful melt electro-written scaffolds with really high porosity. And then we could produce these over really wide areas, which was excellent. We have a lot of control over the fiber diameters that we can produce by very directly controlling the extrusion feed rate. This is one of the excellent features of the Muron system, leveraging a filament-driven extrusion system, where we can really tightly control the rate at which the filament is being driven into the system compared to our air pressure-driven systems of typical melt electrowriting devices. And so here I show some of the optimization steps of controlling the extruder and the bed temperature so that we were able to produce these really beautiful fibers that then fused and stacked really nicely in the scaffold and didn't simply fall apart after deposition. We've shown that the mechanical properties are significantly stiffer than polycaprolactone, which is excellent for this particular application where we need a more mechanically robust scaffold than what we were able to produce with PCL. And this is true in a lot of biomimetic applications where PCL is a reasonably weak polymer, especially when printed at the very high porosities that we achieve with melt electrowriting. So to get substantially stiffer scaffolds using the system was a really excellent result. And so here's just a few examples of where we've printed patient-specific scaffolds that would map across to the individual kind of anatomy of individual ears. And so here's two of my wonderful colleagues who acted as participants in this study, where we patient-matched the design of the scaffolds based on a 2D photo of the ear. And of course, there's a lot of ability for us to do this based on three-dimensional scan data, which is really important for a lot of internal structures. But it was important to us to make sure that we could operate within the existing clinical workflow for patients that would undergo this surgery, and they may not be subject to three-dimensional scanning. And so we wanted to make sure that our workflow could rely on simply an image to be able to create these specific geometries, as well as regions of kind of multiple infill patterns, so we can control the stiffness across the different regions of the ear. So this is really some of the very exciting outcomes of this project, which is the first time we could melt electrolyte high density polyethylene and using the Muron system that Paul introduced. This gives us a lot of control over protecting the materials from thermal degradation that they might be subject to using regular melt electrowriting systems. We are ensuring biocompatibility by using the same material that is used in the FDA cleared implants. And of course, this material has a long history of clinical use and very well established biocompatible properties, which we have demonstrated with the cell attachment study there by plasma treating the scaffold. Melt electrowriting, of course, gives us this really beautiful design freedom that I've been talking about in this presentation, that gives us the ability to control the porosity across a wide range of porosities and scaffold infill patterns. And we know from other studies that this can improve the opportunity for soft tissue and vascular infiltration and improve the long-term stability of these scaffolds for better patient outcomes. And so this is sort of where I'm really excited that this project is heading, is being able to create these permanent surgical implants, incorporate a patient-specific design, and really produce a surgical implant that's going to yield very, very successful outcomes for the patients. So that's sort of the underpinning of how I've been approaching my biofabrication and my melt electrowriting research. And I have an absolutely wonderful team and wonderful collaborators that I'd like to thank that have all participated and contributed to this research. So thank you very much. And I'm happy to take questions.
Oh, we have one question showed up. Just the right timing from Kian. Cool work, MEW. With 30% bioglass is impressive. How much does this affect the process and what are the limitations?
Yeah, so one of the key limitations is the particle size. So here we're using particles that range somewhere around the 8 to 30 micron size. But if they're substantially bigger than that, we can get the clogging of the nozzle, which is one of the key limitations here, is that we found that if we had a too broad a spectrum of particle sizes, that we just simply couldn't print it because it was just getting stuck in the nozzle. Of course, that significantly increases the viscosity of the material composite, so the PCL with the bioglass phase as well. And so we've had a lot of success in then dissolving that into chloroform and then sort of solution electrowriting the composite in that format. But we've also got some ongoing work to show how we can then print that at higher temperatures, so reduce the viscosity of the PCL even further to account for the increase in viscosity that we see with the addition of the bioglass particles. So there are some limitations, of course, once we start solution electrowriting, that kind of adds in another dimension of control over the different parameters that we have to get really beautiful jets and to make sure that the solvent is then evaporating fast enough that we're retaining the morphology of our scaffold after we printed. But we've had some really successful results and we've got some really promising in vivo study results as well, which we hope will be published soon, just showing—
Sounds good.
Yeah, just how successful this scaffold system has been.
So that one of the major application of that is 3D printing bone, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think there is a definitive commercial interest and also scientific interest in that field right now as we're speaking. So very good work. I have a couple of questions just to clarify, because I've seen publication either from your institute or somewhere in Australia using MEW for, or MEW. Should I call that MEW or should I say MEW?
Either's fine.
What makes me sound more like a pro?
Either way, MEW works.
Okay, fine. I see that they can use this technology to create stent, for example. Actually, this is like an area that I really do think as a clinician that there is a lot of need for better stents, because almost all stents cause foreign reaction and they have all kinds of complications as implanted, and it's also not typically personalized. I don't know if those people still till this day for aortic dissection and aneurysm, people actually hand sew some of the stent graft. The surgeons will actually do that, can you imagine? So how far are we? I mean, is this somewhat closer to clinical, or where are you guys with that?
I think there's a lot of really exciting research in this space. I guess bioresorbable stents have had quite a dynamic journey to clinical translation.
Yeah, complications is what she's trying to say.
Yeah, and so I think there is potentially quite a lot of hesitation around sort of going down that route. That being said, using melt electrowriting, and I think as our presentations are showing, to regenerate tissues, so from a tissue engineering perspective and being able to produce vascular grafts, has a huge amount of promise. And there's some really exciting research in this space, not by my team, but by many other teams. that I think we're getting very, very close to some really wonderful solutions for regenerative solutions for vascular grafts.
And then for the implantable structure scaffold that you showed in your presentation, how close are we in terms of large animal study or human study, or where are we now?
So this particular research from our team, we're in, so we've completed our small animal studies and progressing to large animal studies.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Oh, that's one step forward for sure.
We'll
follow up. Okay, another question from the audience. See, have you considered to design a multi-extrusion based system combining bioprinting with MEW in one single machine, or isn't it worth it?
It absolutely is worth it. And we have one in our lab, which is excellent. We have one of our printers has these sort of more universal print heads that, you know, they're housing a syringe with a material and a needle and an air supply, and we have temperature control. Because we have our high voltage then connected to our collector plate, it means we can melt electrolyte if we choose. But then we also can just simply attach more of these in parallel, which we have done, and have bio inks in these to extrude them without voltage or with, as some studies are now showing, to be able to bioprint sort of in parallel or in sequence to melt electroding as well. So yes, and I think that's the great thing about having a lot of kind of a huge kind of research momentum of custom built machinery is that we've got a lot of flexibility to be adding this sort of capacity where there's a need in the research.
Sounds good. We have another question from Lucy. Lovely work. Do you use special seeding strategies to ensure good cell attachment to these highly porous scaffolds, or you seed in a very large number and hope a different number attached to the fibers?
Yeah, there's a few key sort of strategies to getting good cell attachment, because as Lucy has very rightly pointed out, you know, these are very high porosity scaffolds. And as you can imagine, when seeding a droplet of cells in media, many of these would simply pass through the scaffold. So there's a few things we do. Mm-hmm. The first of these is to make our scaffolds hydrophilic. PCL and most thermoplastics are inherently hydrophobic. I mean, it means the media droplet will simply sit on top of the scaffold with the cells in the droplet, and it won't actually penetrate into the scaffold. So there's a lot of different techniques to do this. Sodium hydroxide etching for PCL scaffolds has been the most widely used, and more recently plasma treatment works really well, particularly on materials that don't respond to sodium hydroxide etching, like our polyethylene scaffolds, for example. So then once the scaffold is hydrophilic, it means the droplet will then get sort of absorbed into the scaffold, and so then we have our cells at least interacting with our fibers, and there's a lot of course kind of chemical biochemical kind of interactions between those hydrophilic surfaces and the cells to allow them to attach. And then the second thing that we use is non-treated well plates, so that the cells really are a little demotivated from attaching to the bottom of the well plate and instead sort of encouraged to remain attached and within the scaffold itself. And so we found that helps. There's some other really excellent kind of techniques for elevating the scaffolds so that the cell droplet sort of just sits within the porous scaffold itself and doesn't actually interact with the bottom of the collector plate at all. There's sort of a couple of other ways of increasing that. But I think with those two key components in the first place, that's been really kind of the main ways that we've managed to optimize that.
Cool. Thank you so much, Naomi. Great presentation. We'll come back to you in our panel discussion, but let's move on to our next speaker. By the way, guys, I just want to give a shout out to all of those people in the audience right now. I know some of you guys in midnight or maybe even past midnight. So thanks for staying awake and join us, and vice versa for the Australian audience for waking up and join us. We try to make it work for everybody. So, let's move on to the next speaker. It's Dr. Baran Marani. He actually recently just co-authored a very interesting paper using MEW, focusing on heart valve. And he is currently a PhD candidate at University of Toronto, focusing on heart valves. So take it away.
Thank you very much, Jenny, for your introduction, and thanks very much for inviting me. Let me just share my screen. Okay, can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm going to present an application of MEW for engineering heart valve tissues. The important aspect in this project is how to mimic the mechanical properties of heart valves in these tissue engineered structures. Just to provide a little bit of background, one of the issues that we have in heart valve tissue engineering is that these structures with a variety of approaches, remodel in vivo in a way that the leaflet shrink and creates a leaky valve that has to be replaced within a year or two. Even in some of the approaches that they initially use the high, basically a large coaptation area between the leaflets, that tissue remodeling still occurs and leads to valvular insufficiency and eventually failure. One of the reasons for this maladaptive tissue remodeling is that the radial stiffness in tissue engineered structures are much higher than the native layer levels, and this high radial stiffness leads to sustained negative strain in the valve, especially when the valve is in diastole and it's supposed to be stretched in the radial direction. So that doesn't happen. And the tissue experiences a sustained negative strain, and that leads to tissue transformation, including cell and ECM, or reorientation toward the circumferential direction of the valve. That creates tissue retraction, which also decreases the curvature of the belly area. And this also, again, in return, increases this negative strain and creates a positive feedback loop that basically creates a pathological a remodeling and leads to valve failure. So our hypothesis is that if we mimic the mechanical properties of the valve tissue, basically minimize this deviation from the native valve mechanics, we can create a tissue that can adapt properly to the hemodynamic condition, and we can limit this negative tissue remodeling. So the objective is to characterize first a native pulmonary valve tissue and engineer a valve tissue with prescribed biomimetic mechanical properties. As you see, this is a typical mechanical properties of the valve tissue. This is a stress strain curve in both circumferential and radial direction of the valve. There's a huge difference here, meaning that the tissue is highly anisotropic and also it's highly nonlinear. So this complexity of the mechanical properties prevents it from easily being replicated in tissue engineered structures. So here we the proposed approach is to fabricate the hybrid structure composed of a polymeric scaffold that we will make this with the MEW technology, given that the ability of the approach to create a wide range of fiber architectures, and then cellularize this structure using fibrin hydrogel as a cell carrier, and then creates a hybrid tissue that can mimic the mechanical properties of a native valve tissue. And the reason that we target pediatric pulmonary valve is that this basically in a high demand because children with congenital heart disease usually have dysfunctional pulmonary valve, and those are in basically the most dire need of tissue engineered structures that can grow and regenerate in the body. In the first step, we characterized pediatric pulmonary valve tissues from porcine valves because their physiology is very similar to human. The physiology of their heart is very similar to human and can be considered as a model for human heart valves. So we characterize these valve tissues using biaxial mechanical testing and determine their stress strain behavior in the circumferential and radial direction of the valve. Basically, this is the radial direction of the valve, and this is the circumferential direction of the valve. And then we aim to mimic this mechanical properties primarily with the fibrous scaffold that we make with MEW by taking into account various architectural parameters of the scaffold in a sinusoidal fiber architecture, including six architectural parameters such as fiber spacing, fiber wave amplitude, and fiber wavelength in the circumferential and radial direction of the scaffold. So there are, in total, there are six parameters that we need to optimize to basically have a target mechanical properties. And if we plan to do this experimentally, for example, using design of experiments, we need to have 2^6 + 1, 65 different architectures to test and to optimize the mechanics, which is going to be a very labor intensive. So what we did was to use computational modeling to optimize all of these six parameters and then perform experimental optimization on the reduced number of parameters to achieve optimized scaffold architecture. So basically, the scaffold was modeled in COMSOL multiphysics and a combination of computational modeling and design of experiments. We were able to optimize the architecture of the fibers, as I mentioned, fiber spacing in two directions, fiber wave amplitude in two directions, and then fiber wavelength in two directions to achieve stress strain behavior that's similar to the native tissue. Here, black is showing native and red shows the simulated scaffold mechanical properties. So after this experiment, after this computational optimization, we moved forward to fabricating the scaffold using the MEW technology. So among these parameters, we found out that fiber amplitude is the most important and most influential factor to impact the mechanical properties. So for this purpose, we decided to choose this parameter to fine-tune experimentally, and with that, we can account for any errors that's involved intrinsically in the mechanical, in computational modeling. So as you see with this technology, we can make fibers with different amplitudes and with the great control that this provides over fiber architecture, we can make a variety of scaffolds and then fine-tune the mechanics. So with the with fiber wave amplitude in the circumferential and radial direction, let's say this is the computationally derived point. And then we defined five different points around that computationally determined fiber amplitude to determine with what wave amplitude we can achieve target mechanical properties. For example, let's say if we have a very small amplitude in the circumferential direction, the stress strain curve shows very high stiffness of the tissue, much higher than the native tissue. Or if we have it very soft in this condition, like high wave amplitude, we get a stress strain behavior that's softer than native tissue. So having these fiber architecture and mechanical properties, we can correlate these two and in reverse, we can find out with what fiber architecture we can achieve target mechanical properties. So this was performed, and we found out the architecture that was expected to create mechanical properties, biaxial properties, similar to the native tissue. The scaffold underwent biaxial mechanical testing, and based on the area between the curve and the vertical axis, we determined that the deviation is in average is about 10% or less. So with that, the MEWS technology and combination of experimental and computational optimization were able to achieve a target mechanical architecture with which we can create native-like mechanical properties. So next, the scaffolds were cellularized, as I mentioned, using cell type called human umbilical cord perivascular cells that can be an autologous cell source for pediatric patients that were suspended in fibrin hydrogel that was used as a cell carrier to cellularize the structure. And they were cultured for up to 3 weeks. This is a small scaffold showing over different stages of the biofabrication. After 3 weeks, we got relatively large cell viability, increasing cell density, integration of fibers and the cell secreted ECM. Which is very important in the heart valve application, because we want these pores to be filled up and the tissue should be basically impermeable to blood flow. So from this aspect, that the tissue showed proper integrity and morphology. Next stage, we wanted to see how much the hydrogel or the addition of cells and secreted ECM and the hydrogel can impact their mechanical properties. So this is a tissue that was cultured for 1 week. After 1 week of culture, they showed minimal difference minimal change in mechanical properties. This is pre-culture deviation from mechanics and post-culture deviation of mechanics in both circumferential and radial direction, which is difference is not significant. So showing that the addition of hydrogel and cultured for at least for 1 week, at least it doesn't impact the mechanical properties of the structure. And the scaffold is the primary contributor to the mechanics. So for larger periods of culture, for example, if you culture the scaffold for 3 weeks, there is a meaningful the difference between the pre-culture mechanics and post-culture mechanics. As expected, the tissue got stiffer. So we also use DOE and experimental optimization to account for this difference and down design to the scaffold to still achieve a mechanical property similar to the native tissue. The deviation was basically with that optimization, the deviation was still below, in average, below 10%. So another thing that we were interested was to see how much we can, like what kind of mechanics we can generate in addition to a heart valve. So if you recall, this is the mechanical properties of a pediatric pulmonary valve is highly nonlinear and highly anisotropic. We chose two different tissues, one adult aortic valve tissue with a smaller degree of anisotropy and a smaller degree of nonlinearity, and then porcine pediatric pericardium. Pericardium is also a very useful tissue, especially for reconstruction of pediatric heart valve that's being used in clinical practice. So this tissue has a very nonlinear mechanics, but isotropic in contrast with the pediatric pulmonary valve. So we wanted to see if we can repeat this, the whole pipeline, and see if we can generate this, the mechanics of this tissue to show that this approach is robust, and it's versatile to create different types of mechanical properties. So this is the scaffold with optimized architecture for engineering aortic valve tissue, and this is the scaffold for engineering pericardium tissue. So they both were cellularized, and then we show that the final mechanics is similar to the native tissue with minimal difference. Showing that we can actually make a valve with this method, first the scaffold was scaled up. It was cellularized with hydrogel cultured for 3 weeks, and then we used a supporting frame to construct the valve, which is a common method, at least for in vitro testing for tissue engineering applications. For in vivo testing, this can be replaced with an expandable stent or a bioresorbable stent. But at this stage, as we wanted to test it in vitro, this 3D printed supporting frame would be sufficient. So the valve tissue was constructed, and this is a valve from the arterial view. This is from the ventricular view, and then underwent hemodynamic testing under physiological pulmonary pressures, and showed valvular sufficiency similar to the native valve. This is the pressure profile for the upper side of the valve, and the blue is for the ventricular side of the valve, and you see that the valve is able to create this pressure difference, showing that the valve is not leaky and can perform properly. Also, in terms of the transvalvular pressure in the systole, when the blood basically flows through the valve, the resistance that the valve creates is within the range determined by the ISO standard. So with that, this research is ongoing. The ongoing work is basically studying if valves with native mechanics, basically testing this hypothesis that valve with native mechanics have a better tissue remodeling properties, and we can mitigate the adverse tissue remodeling with this replication of native mechanics. And in summary, so the established method is a generalizable approach, combining computational modeling, experimental optimization to generate tissues with prescribed mechanical properties, including aspects such as high tissues with high nonlinearity and high anisotropy. And then tri-leaflet pulmonary valves that developed showed in vitro valvular sufficiency. So with that, I want to end my presentation. I want to thank all the co-authors of the work that we recently published, and the funding resources that support this study.
Thank you, Baron. Excellent presentation. I've seen quite a few startups actually focusing on bioprinting heart components. I mean, there's still ongoing research in this area, or actually right. trying to commercialize. Now, can you just explain to us this valve that you created that is only going through in vitro testing? How right. close it to currently implanted valves? I think there is one is a tissue-based valve and the other one is a mechanical metal, I believe.
Right.
So yeah, can you just teach us a little bit about this?
Right, sure. So right now the valves that are being used in clinical practice are either mechanical valves or bioprosthetic valves that are from fixed animal tissues. Both of them have major limitations. For example, the mechanical valve has a risk of blood coagulation, and the patient has to get to take anticoagulatory drug over their lifetime. And the bioprosthetic valve has an endurance problem, so they have a lifetime of about 10 to 15 years. Especially for the pediatric patient, none of these valves grow. So the patient has to get their heart valve replaced every now and then that they outgrow their heart valve. So that's where tissue engineering comes into place. So the aim is to create a living tissue that can grow with the patient. And this research right now, there are animal studies going on, showing that they can function in 1 to 2 years in vivo. And there are a very limited number of clinical trials. For example, Zeltis, a company, I think it's based in Zurich and Eindhoven, they have done a couple or maybe three clinical trial. So some of the results are published. They're somehow promising, but the research is but that adverse tissue remodeling is still a challenge. So what we are trying here to tackle is to create a tissue that can have homeostatic properties in vivo. So right now, a colleague of mine is working on implanting these tissues into porcine model as the first animal study, and then down the road, if that's successful, can move forward to clinical trial.
Fantastic. Yeah, the pediatric population is pretty underserved, if anything, and this makes sense. So thank you so much for your presentation. And guys, put your questions in the Q&A box later on. Okay, we are moving on to our last but not the least speaker. Thank you so much. Philippos Torlamousis. Actually, I think he's a professor as well. And he is also the founder and CEO of Biological Lattice Industries. It's a startup VC-backed AI-driven robotic biofabrication platform for tissue engineering and regenerative medicine. And he told me he was inspired by actually Paul, by his research. So we're coming into a full circle. If Philippos, can you join me? Can you click on the webinar button in the bottom so you can join me on stage? Because right now we can't see you. Or actually, you know what? Let me just do it for you. There we go. There we go. Finally, we have conquered a lot of challenges today to make you make it happen. So, yeah. So Philippos, I'm really glad that you joined us today because, you know, one of the, I would say, representatives from an entrepreneur and also scientist perspective. So love to hear, you know, what you're working on and how it's relevant to MEW presentations today.
Yeah, great. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, thank you very much, Jenny, again, for all the support from the early days. And, you know, I did my PhD, basically spent 5 years working with melt electrowriting. And I hope that I can convince, even as a founder, about how powerful this method is for basic research and cell biology. I won't present too much data from my PhD. I try to show it through the lens of the company that we are trying to build the last 3 years. And BLI is a company that has gone under many waves. We design and manufacture AI-powered biofabrication tools, both software and hardware. And these are tools that aim to help researchers, both in the public and the private sector, to do research faster and more reliably, but also innovate as well. One step back, you know, every discovery starts with a vial of cells. And, you know, those cells have a circular shape when they are in suspension. And then the next step is always we culture them on two-dimensional glassware. And those cells start changing morphology, they attach, they proliferate, they, you know, they self-replicate until the, you know, they change shape and the flask and the surface becomes confluent. And the goal actually is to increase the number. We call it cell expansion, but also we want to make sure what kind of functionality do we induce the cells at the end. And, you know, more or less, this doesn't work most of the times. And in order to achieve that, we use chemicals, chemical signals. So, you know, considering that step, initial step in preclinical medical research and the high failure rate for, you know, medical for therapies and specifically drugs in clinical trials, which the amount is enormous, and also facts from the literature that at the preclinical phase, we fund non-reproducible research and we try to make products out of this, there is an urgent need of how biology labs will operate in the future, in the next 10 years. And even the largest manufacturer of two-dimensional culture plates, Corning, says that these are necessary but increasingly insufficient. And we envision as a company to those plates to be functionalized with scaffolds, and specifically melt electroreten scaffolds or other types of scaffolds. But you know, we built a company around this technology, and I will show this how. So the time is now, because even you know last year the FDA Modernization Act was voted, and you know we are changed the regulation that actually you know controls how we define what is safety and efficacy for drugs. Has been updated, and actually, the you know the people are motivated to do that, not using animals, but also engineered models. And these models basically are going to be biomaterial scaffold models. So the interesting part is that it's a huge market, but somehow it's extremely fragmented. That's you know a side comment. But the solution here is in this space. Those scaffolds. And the power of melt electrowriting is that it allows you to have geometrical feature sizes down to the single cell level. And why is that powerful? Because, you know, as I mentioned before, we usually, whenever we culture cells, you know, on two-dimensional plates or even on scaffolds, we drive the functionality mostly from chemical signals. And this is based on this, you know, classical dogma of cell biology that says, you know, all the information is in the DNA, and you know the function, which means you know we create proteins, goes one way from DNA to you know transcription, translation down to the protein formation. And why don't we reverse that actually? And this is a wild idea, and I have faced a lot of criticism from biologists about that. But we envision to use you know, melt electrowriting scaffolds specifically because they give you this huge design space of architectures that allow you to tune cell shapes down to the protein level. And by changing, you know, the shape at the macro scale, but also at the subcellular level, you can induce changes at the DNA and control in a more physical way, you know, the functionality at the end. So, you know, imagine having, you know, a melt electrowriting printer, and depending on its accuracy and how well it prints the scaffolds, this is how well, and also this translates also to the reproducibility of your results in your cell biology experiments. So, you know, the process is, you know, as everyone described before, you know, in the panel, I won't stay here. We can see in that slide that at the mesoscale there is very interesting there are very interesting things can happen for cell biology. Those melt electroreten scaffolds and you know I term them BLI, but also we are going to offer also FDM scaffolds as well. You know can be produced it's within a scalable manufacturing automated process, and this is what we have been building in the lab. Here in the company, using you know no chemical solvents, medical grade polymer melts, you know all this good stuff, but building this technology platform, we would like to monetize it as well and give it away and show it to people. And as previous speakers mentioned before, indeed, in order to have this instrumentation and buy it is very expensive. And I agree with that. Over-engineered bioprinters, extremely expensive, but also there is a lot of room for software development, I believe, in order to harness the capabilities of this process. So we have shown in the past that actually we can tune single cell shapes in 3D in a very homogeneous way. And you can very efficiently tune the cell shape phenotype, but also you can tune the functionality as well. And we've shown that with mesenchymal stromal cells and in the lab here with iPSCs and organoids as well. So we enter the market with first by monetizing the whole platform that we call it Luminous platform. And specifically, we enter with the product on the left side because after talking with customers, there is a big need and desire for research groups around the world to have, you know, a complete system that is as close as possible and takes into account the real world applications, which means the regulatory pathway. So BioLoom on the left side is a modular AI-driven bioprinter with multiple processes for multi-scale and multi-material printing capabilities. But also on the right side, we plan to launch a self-driving biomaterial R&D lab, not relevant to melt electrolyting, mostly for people who are willing to work with hydrogels. And I'm going to show now a couple of things about BioLoom. So of course, it's open materials and consumables. We don't offer these. It has 7 heads. And are configurable in, you know, you can choose to have melt electrolyting, you know, for different materials combined with, you know, bioprinting, fused deposition modeling. But the interesting thing that we saw and we tried to fill in, we identified this gap in the bioprinting instrumentation market is the fact that, you know, whenever you wanted to have a bioprinter with active temperature and humidity control, also built-in sterilization and ionization, deionization, you would go at the order of $100,000 to $200,000. We are significantly lower than that. Another interesting thing about BioLoom is the software. So we basically have developed the last 3 years with the software team, a grasshopper, if you know this node-based environment that rhinoceros offer, you know, it's this philosophy. We're trying to, for biofabrication, actually, and we're trying to represent scaffold geometries as computational graphs. So one fact is the Loom designer, you can design with G-code, we can design with, you know, parametric Python code, the right G-code, you have access, and I'll try to show a small demo about this in a minute, but also, after that, everything is connected in this node environment where you can control the machine as well with the commander, but also add nodes related to machine learning if you want to close the loop, either for the process, but also for the design phase. I'm going to show a small video about the software. So, for example, we can see it here. We can see scaffolds represented as computational graphs. Each node represents, you know, one single geometrical operation. And, you know, in each step, you can add viewers to look at your scaffold, G-code editors, you can parameterize it, and you can add also nodes to do optimization, design of experiments, Bayesian optimization, if you want to do, it's just a universal operating system for biofabrication. This is what we envision. So that's all from me, and I'm happy to share to take any questions.
Okay, I think my burning question is, Philippos, how much is this going to cost me?
Oh yeah, it's going to cost you if you are an early adopter, around $30,000.
Yeah. Okay. If I'm a researcher? I'm a researcher in Greece. How much is going to cost me?
30,000 euros.
Okay.
And you know, it's you know, if you do a research in the market, you're going to see that it's 5-4 times smaller compared to, you know, what you could get for all these capabilities.
Cool. And what are the applications that you guys are working on? Are you working on any applications with the current technology?
Yeah. We have to work with with customers because we work around their applications and we develop stuff. We have people who are working with vascular tissue engineering for different types of indications. There we see that there is a need for the multi-layer, multi-processes that we need to have in the bioprinter. They worry about that the bioprinting process is slow, so they want multiple heads to print parallel. We work with people that do stem cell biology research, and specifically organoids. They want to grow organoids in a very uniform way, or they want to grow organoids much larger, and melt electrolyting are wonderful around that. They allow you to grow larger organoids with smaller necrotic core. Very interesting stuff for the cell biology stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering about the speed as well. I mean, it looks like a very slow process, if you have just one single strand working. But with your multi-head, are you comparable to, standard bioprinting company, bioprinters that's on the market in terms of speed, per volume, per unit time, in terms of how much you can produce?
For melt electrolyting, you mean? So I don't think, I don't think that I'm faster per scaffold. We are faster per scaffold, but you can print, if you want to do an experimental setup of six scaffolds and a six well plate, you have six heads and you can print in parallel. You will need just one day to get your six scaffolds. So we scale out. We haven't scaled up. The speed remains slow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good. We have a audience question. What fiber diameter range has been achieved by this particular machine? Is it limited to PCL in terms of material?
So it's not limited to PCL. We've been working with PCL, but whatever you see in the literature that is has been used with melt electrolyting, you can use it. You cannot use very high polymer melts that have high melting temperature range above 200 degrees Celsius. You can achieve the classical fiber diameter range that you see in the literature from single microns up to, 100. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds good. Now I'm going to invite all the speakers to come on to join me in the webinar. I just have a couple concluding questions, kind of want to have a panel discussion about this. Frankly, this is actually, I read a little bit about MEW before this event. I did some research, read some articles, but I learned a lot, even a lot more from this webinar today myself. It almost sounds like in certain way, that MEW is better than the conventional bioprinting right now. Now, my question is, all of you guys encountered bioprinting and 3D printing, the conventional 3D printing at some point in your professional life, and what made you decide to branch out into MEW? Is this something that's, I wouldn't say really needed, but like, what gravitates you to change, kind of focus more on this super new additive manufacturing process? I'll start with you, Filippo, since you're already the last one speaker.
Okay. So, it's a very simple story, actually. When I started my PhD, I got hired by a professor, a new professor. I was his first student, who came from the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the US. And he was working in the biomaterials division there, and they were trying to set up standards for the tissue engineering and regenerative medicine industry that was upcoming, metrology standards. And he came with, at that time, couple 8 years ago, 9 years ago, too much time, he came with a well plate filled in with all the scaffold architectures that someone could produce. you could see porous leech scaffold, so salt leech scaffolds with random porous architecture, or you could see fused deposition model scaffolds or hydrogel-based scaffolds with bioprinting. And the big question from NIST at that point was, they ran experiments with stem cells for all these different scaffold architectures, and they saw that the functionality basically comes, you know, from chemical signals. So you could have all the scaffolds and you would put chemical signals and all the scaffolds would give you the same outcome for stem cell differentiation. Only one scaffold would induce without chemical signals, you know, tunable functionality. And these were electrospun membranes. So he asked me find a way where we can fill in this missing dimensional gap at the single cell level. And I came across Paul's paper, specifically an advanced materials paper, which is, you know, a seminal paper in the field. And I started replicating the process.
Very cool. Well, Paul, you're the origin of this whole thing. So what was the magical moment?
I was working in the biomaterials field, and, you know, our job, our gig is to translate materials. And it just made so much more sense to be working with processes and melts. And, you know, I never really was convinced by bioprinting, extrusion-based bioprinting, because I also did a lot of pipetting in the lab in the 90s with gels, and, you know, the cells didn't suddenly do amazing things. So just by having a robot do that dispensing didn't really convince me. So as time's gone on, I think bioprinting's gone through its hype, and it's now probably over the lip. If you look at the NIH funding now, it's decreasing with bioprinting. And comparatively, extrusion-based bioprinting's probably had billions and billions of R&D dollars spent. MEW, I would guess maybe 30 million, maybe. And so if you kind of compare what's been done with the limited amount of money that's been directed towards the field versus the huge opportunity that bioprinting had, from what I understand, there's only two human implants for extrusion-based bioprinting, and that study was stopped due to contraction of the construct. So, you know, that's the thing. With time will tell. And I think as well, 5 years from now, see where things are at, because, you know, you have to have progression and you have to have that clinical translation.
Yeah, I did a little research on my own on PubMed before this event. And I think the uptick of bioprinting publication is started in 2004, 2005, that period of time. And a significant uptick of MEW, I mean, which still is small in number compared to the rest, is about 2017, believe it or not. I don't know. Does that sound right to you? Because that's what I saw.
That's about right.
Sounds about right. Yeah. So it's a very young kind of focus area.
And, you know, people here and other people around the world, you know, I think once you start working with it, you kind of can get quite addicted to it, because you can make these remarkable structures that you're programming and you're seeing these changes and you can reiterate. And, you know, it's for me, it's a kind of logical step for making more advanced biomaterials, because you still have to follow law and regulatory processes. And, you know, luckily enough, MEW is in the slipstream of fused deposition modeling, which has made clinical products now. So there is a path there for it. It just needs more researchers to innovate and try things out and then start going through the process. But I do imagine we'll have human trials in the next 5 years.
My biggest question is this, you know, is MEW actually going to be faster than 3D bioprinting in actually churning out implantable devices? So Naomi, next to you, something you're working on now. What was your magic moment of, you know, really love MEW?
Yeah, look, I think I've almost come at this the exact other way, because it probably took maybe 2 or 3 years after starting in the in the melt electrowriting field before I actually normally 3D printed something. So all of the first products I've ever 3D printed have been melt electrowritten. And that's because I was extremely fortunate to be part of the first cohort of the biofabrication master's program that Paul established between QUT and the University of Wollongong in Australia and the University of Würzburg and Utrecht in Europe. And I think it's interesting that you point out this you know, there was this big uptake in multiple electrowriting research in 2017 that was
probably
in huge part due to the massive increase in, you know, all of these biofabrication master's students coming through and our work, you know, finally being published after, you know, the normal amount of time. And so I think that, and Paul has obviously championed building a lot of research.
It's a long-term investment. Started with Paul, but everyone here as well. Yeah, I'm starting investing in this now. So, and Baron, what about you?
During my master's, I worked with microextrusion 3D printing for different applications, including tissue engineering. And one of the issues with that was the tissue didn't have enough integrity for, especially for connective tissue engineering, such as heart valves. So when I started my PhD in 2018, So we were interested in replicating native tissue mechanics, and valve tissue is a very stiff tissue. So we were looking at something fibrous, and I was I came across one of about like a year or 2 years after, I came across one of Paul's papers on creating different structures like wavy fibers and a variety of architectures that we can make with this technology, and a lot of these are actually mimicking some of the architectures that we have in native tissues, like such as collagen crimps, that's responsible for nonlinear mechanics of all of our connective tissues. So I guess this MEW appeared to be a very strong technology because we have superior control over fiber architecture, and with that we can have a very good control over mechanical properties. So that was the main motivation of us moving forward this technology.
I remember I had a conversation with I forgot who it was, but I think the main attraction to bioprinting for a lot of people, biologists, scientists, is the ability to control. You know, instead of pipetting, now we have a robot to pipette. And now I feel like MEW perhaps having, you know, like what Philippos was saying, it's down to single cell control. And so we're now having more and more control. And so this sounds like a step up, actually, from a biomanufacturing process. We have one question from the audience. I thought it was interesting. What printing parameters would you recommend for new MEW users to get started with? I think Paul just published a paper on this. And what would this make? How easy is it to make those multi-layer scaffolds? That's a lot of questions. That's not one question anymore. We'll start with the first one, parameters. I mean, or maybe just the paper to read, maybe. That your paper pretty much said, I couldn't open that paper. So unfortunately I don't have the PDF.
Yeah, I mean, there's a review from a few years ago called Taming the Jet. And that's probably a good start. The process is kind of forgiving. It's not like everything has to be dialed into specific values. And, you know, I would, you know, first off, try and get some medical grade PCL because there's a standard that's out there that a lot of papers are written on, and you'll find those numbers will be very similar to each other.
Okay.
That would be the recommendation.
Great. What about,
I was going to say, if the person doesn't have that particular polymers, just send me a message and we can send some few grams to start that.
Wow. Kind of offer. What about what kind of scaffold they should start off with to try out this technology?
I think everyone just does grid patterns. That's easy to program, the 090. You know, that's why they're made, is because they're easy to program.
Okay.
But, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, it's great to see Barham start working with the wavy structures, and then, you know, you're just kind of reverse engineering. What is it that you want? And then you're seeing stiffening, so you're like even going back to the drawing board and doing those cycles. So you can really get a whole spectrum of mechanics through the kind of wavy structures. So probably start with a grid and then wavy structures.
Cool. Thank you so much. But I also want to generalize this question so that other speakers can, you know, input a little bit of, you know, if you're a new MEW user, first of all, it's really hard to get a printer, because you know, it took me almost half a year to put together a 3D printer myself. I cannot imagine putting this together from a conventional printer. So anyone has any ideas of how to access the printer and then how to get it to work as a beginner?
I think there's a couple of really excellent publications that have detailed how to build from scratch a custom built machine.
Okay.
Our team has published one. There's several papers out there that have some really great work instructions and a lot of the, you know, all of the CAD drawings and everything in supplementary. Mm-hmm. That would be excellent for, you know, a really experienced engineer that wants a big, like, building project.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, and I'm just going to spruik Paul's team's wonderful Muron project, where they have used the Voron Foundation that has a lot of, you know, open source material and a lot of, you know, instructional help online to be able to build that component and then be able to, at a very low cost, adapt that into a Muron. I think that is now the benchmark and the starting point for melt electrowriting. It's probably the lowest cost and the lowest kind of barrier to entry that I've seen for to build a machine from scratch.
Is this the Voron design website that I shared? Is that correct? Okay, so people just go on there and get a lot of resources then.
Yeah, so maybe we can share Paul's paper that then detailed the Muron conversion, and they've got all of the files required to be able to do that in that paper. It's a really wonderful resource.
So I'm happy to share that. Yeah, we always have a follow-up email with our attendees, and people who aren't live right now, they're still going to watch. I mean, 90% of our people actually watch offline when we're not live. So I can share these links, you know, to your publications in addition to the video.
Then the only other comment I think I'd make there is that a lot of different countries have very different electrical safety standards. And I'm in Australia, where we have very, very strict electrical safety standards about what kind of electrical work we can do in the lab and the sorts mm-hmm. of safety mechanisms that we need built into our machines. So it is really important for new users to be quite cognizant of the research environment that they're operating in and just make sure that they're compliant with their expectations around doing their own electrical work or making sure that they have particular safety systems. That being said, you know, these machines aren't wildly unsafe, and I think there's a lot of stigma that gets attached to the high voltage systems that we're using, of course, which can of course be very dangerous in some circumstances, but there are some really safe mechanisms that can be incorporated to make sure that these are, you know, very, very low risk devices, and so it's just something for people to be aware of.
I never thought it's been a high risk device until you talk about it, Naomi, but thanks for the warning. And Philippos, do you have any suggestion for newcomers to the field?
Oh, for newcomers in the field, yeah. Learn how to program in Python or in MATLAB so that they can, you know, design what they have in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, absolutely. Open source projects. You know, I'm very opinionated about open source projects. So be very careful. The Muron thing project is very well documented, as opposed to other, you know, projects that when you start to build something, because I've done it in the past many times, you arrive at a point, you know, where, you know, you don't have clear instructions. So, you know, Voron is based on this open source philosophy, deeply in its roots. So I would start from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about you, Barham?
I think there are a lot of great methods paper published in MEW. Actually, I started from there. A lot of them are from Paul's group. So I guess, like for example, I came across a paper like detailing the method for printing PCL specifically, and like most of the parameters and things work for me to start with, and then when it gets started, then gets easier to changing geometry or tweaking the different things would be more straightforward. So I guess there are lots of resources that can be used for new users.
Awesome. We have one question from the audience, and I'm going to say this is going to be our last question, is do you think we will get to the point of building large 3D or macro structures with MEW along, similar to what we can do with the extrusion FDM kind of 3D printing, do you think we have to have hybrid manufacturing to be able to achieve that scale?
I've been around long enough to never say no, you can't do something. So that's the easiest way to be proven wrong. So you can say, oh, that's not possible. And so I think, you know, I look forward to the day then we have a similar amount of R&D investment as bioprinting, extrusion-based bioprinting has. And I think you'll see like a whole spectrum of innovations that come out of this, potentially including like really large-scale fabrication of structures, which other fields may also be driving, not just biomedical, but other industries that require certain high-performance materials.
Absolutely. And Philippos, do you have any thoughts on this large scale with your automated process?
Oh, I think that's a great question. I used to think about that a lot. And I think the way that this could be done is by having like a Lego approach where you have prefabricated MEW scaffolds and then you do discrete assembly and then you have large structures at very high speed, like semiconductor industry. So that was my thought back in the day. But
yeah, like a modular manufacturing process. Yeah. Naomi?
Oh, look, I agree with these comments. I think we've got a lot of physics to consider in this particular process, which will need some very smart minds working on it. But I think, as Paul said, never say never. There's a lot of research momentum in this space, and I'm really excited to see where it goes. So hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, I'm not looking, as a doctor, I'm not looking for giant scaffold. Okay, we're only so big. And I'm just happy to have a little valve or a partial ear. I think that size, I'm satisfied with that for now. Baron, what about you?
Well, for our application for heart valve, especially for pediatric for heart valve, where we need scaffolds in the size of 4 centimeters by 1.5 centimeters. So in this scale, every scaffold takes us about 8 hours to print. Okay. And that's not too bad, I think.
Not too bad, yeah.
I think it's, the high accuracy of fiber deposition comes with the cost of low fabrication process. Low fabrication speed. And so in general, I think probably like one of the limitation of MEW is that it's slow compared to many other, like if you compare it, for example, with jet spinning per se. But they don't have that degree of control over fiber architecture. But in terms of the valve application, I think it's the timing that I mentioned is not too bad. It's especially the process is very reliable. We print out most of our scaffolds overnight, so we don't need to be attending to the printing process.
Right, and if we can automate the process, then we don't have to pay attention at it. Definitely. I think this is gonna hopefully follow the Moore's law, not just faster but better. I'm pretty optimistic. Maybe I need to read more about this, but I think this field has a lot of potential. I know there's one question left that we can't address, but I think I'm going to write an article about this event, actually. So stay tuned for that. I think in terms of what applications we can use MEW, there are a lot of publications out there. Almost every single organ system could potentially use MEW. The question is, which one can actually come into the clinics? And I think our speakers today kind of addressed those likely fields, like the skin component, valve, implants. These are probably going to come up first, since already very close animal testing and human testing. So, but anyways, thanks so much for everybody to join us today. This is so insightful and educational. I learned so much, and I feel like I missed out the last decade. So thank you very much for teaching me and also the audience. And we will widely share this recording at no cost to people. And I will share the link using the email and social media. So thank you so much, everyone, again, for the speakers to donate their time to share with us. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.